So our next case for argument is Fields v. Wary. Mr. Garcia.
Good morning. May it please the Court. This matter comes before the Court a second time. I'm raising an interesting and very important issue regarding qualified immunity and how that applies to a claim of the alleged fabrication of evidence. Although it's a qualified immunity issue, I suggest this case is really about the erosion of absolute prosecutorial immunity. Because the practical effect of the district court's decision to reverse his prior ruling and revive the claim against Assistant State's Attorney Wary is that it really opens up the door for criminal defendants, who then become plaintiffs in civil cases, to turn around and sue prosecutors for decisions they make all the time about witness testimony that they present in court. And that's essentially what happened here. It's a case where a number of witnesses flipped. You have that happening all the time. That's a reality. And that's something the Supreme Court addressed in its original opinion, is that witness veracity is in question oftentimes before and after they testify. And so in a case like this, it really just opens up the possibility that the prosecutor, who is immune for presenting that testimony at court, will then be sued based on the alleged fabrication itself. The case, we are also back here on the district court's ruling on the state's attorney defendant's motion to dismiss the state law claims on the basis of absolute prosecutorial immunity. We were here before with respect to the 1983 claims. All of the 1983 claims were dismissed, and so all that was remaining until the district court's opinion in December of 2012 was the state law claims. And by virtue of that opinion, after this court's decision in Whitlock versus Brueggemann, a 1983 claim was revived against ASA Wary with respect to the alleged fabrication of evidence, the testimony of Anthony Summer. Defendants suggest it's important this court reaffirm its prior decisions in Buckley versus Fitzsimmons, often referred to as Buckley 4, which was the case here after remand from the Supreme Court, as well as in this very case itself, where the court discussed the issue of qualified immunity, specifically with respect to the fact that the fabrication of evidence itself did not state a constitutional
violation. I don't really understand that. And it doesn't seem consistent with Whitlock. I think we've gotten ourselves into a problem here. They seem completely inconsistent. Can you just use a prosecutor as an investigator and by doing that create absolute immunity? And he can do anything he wants and there's no sanction?
Judge, I think that's the question you were pressing last time, and that had to do more with the scope of absolute prosecutorial immunity. Here we're dealing with the question of whether the fabrication of evidence in of itself states a constitutional violation.
I don't understand that. If you have the prosecutor does the investigation, then some other prosecutor prosecutes, say. So he's just doing an investigation. But if he has absolute immunity, then he can fabricate evidence and so on with impunity. So is that proper?
Judge, that raises an issue that's not present in this case because the prosecutors actually did try the case here. And that's why we think this is important.
What if they hadn't tried the case?
Then you raise the issue, I suppose we go back to Jones versus City of Chicago. And the question with regard to whether
what's the answer?
Well, the answer would be it's possible that the prosecutor would be liable in that case simply for fabricating the evidence, but it would depend upon whether or not that information was conveyed to the trial attorney. And that's something that was involved in this court's discussion in the previous decision in this case with regard to assistance.
So the prosecutor fabricates evidence and transmits it to the prosecuting prosecutor who doesn't know that it's fabricated. And so you're saying in that situation the investigating prosecutor would lose his absolute immunity. Is that what you're saying?
Well, with respect to the absolute immunity, we're not talking about absolute immunity here because that's the only reason the question of whether or not it states a constitutional violation in and of itself is important. We don't want to conflate the issues of absolute immunity because presumptively, we're not talking about absolute immunity for the investigation.
Oh, I don't understand. Look, you have to be simpler if you want to communicate with me. I'm imagining a case where you have a prosecutor who is assigned to investigate. He investigates, he fabricates evidence, he gives the fabricated evidence to the, you know, his colleague who's conducting the actual prosecution in court, and that prosecutor doesn't know that he is using fabricated evidence. Now, is the first one, the one who just did investigating, does he have absolute immunity if he's sued for fabricating evidence, you know, malicious prosecution?
It would depend on the time frame. If it's during the prosecution, then the answer would be
I don't
yes.
understand you. I said he does the investigation first. Then he gives the stuff to the prosecutor, does the prosecution. Obviously, that's second. That's later. Now, can the first prosecutor, the investigator, does he retain absolute immunity if he's sued for malicious prosecution?
I apologize for not being clear, Your Honor, but my answer still depends on whether we're talking about whether the prosecution is ongoing or not. Because the absolute immunity issue, as it's been decided under Buckley,
it's ongoing. There's a prosecution. The defendant is convicted. This fabricated evidence. And later he sues this investigating prosecutor for malicious prosecution. Now, does this investigator have absolute immunity?
The answer is yes.
Yes?
He's preparing evidence for a trial. I understand the question, in an ongoing prosecution.
I don't get it.
There's a great deal of conceptual difficulty in this area, and we need to sort it out here,
and
we need some help in sorting it out, and that's what Judge Posner's questions are directed at. I think it's more helpful to think about the problem in terms of what the constitutional claims are, as opposed to this elaborate theory of causation that some of the cases, Whitlock in particular, introduced into the doctrine.
I agree.
The possible universe of constitutional claims are Fourth Amendment claims, right, that occur during the
Correct.
Investigative phase
Correct.
Of the case before the probable cause hearing, before judicial process attaches.
Correct.
Once judicial process attaches, and we've got cases that say this, then we move into the domain of due process violations. But those are different kinds of claims. But the mere creation of false evidence or coercion of fabricated testimony is not an actionable constitutional wrong.
And that's our point.
Wherever it occurs. It is an actionable constitutional wrong to the extent that it amounts to a false arrest and a false charge, and that's actionable as a Fourth Amendment violation, right? And you can bring that claim against a police officer, and you can bring that claim against a prosecutor. There's no immunity there.
I agree,
because
Judge,
process
there are no
hasn't
Fourth Amendment
attached.
Claims in this case. That's why we're talking about trial based.
Okay. So Wary can be sued to the extent that he coerced false testimony against Fields on a Fourth Amendment theory because it contributed to his arrest. And so he's got a false arrest claim. And he can get damages for that. Would you concede that?
I would concede that. There are no Fourth Amendment claims. There's no Fourth Amendment or false arrest claims in this case.
Okay, but apart from what claims are being alleged here, just work with me on as a doctrinal matter. That's a good claim against the prosecutor or against the officer who participated in getting that coerced statement from the witness.
As this court has discussed in cases like Brooks versus City of Chicago and that line
okay.
of cases. Yes.
Okay, no immunity there.
Right.
But that's a Fourth Amendment claim, and the damages are limited to the Fourth Amendment damages for the wrongful
yes.
arrest. Okay. Once we've moved into the due process domain, in other words, once judicial process attaches, there's been a probable cause finding, everything that a prosecutor does in that aspect of the case, that phase of the case, is absolutely immunized. He can't be sued for anything.
I agree.
He can't be sued for a Brady violation, which is a due process violation, failure to comply with the duty to disclose, which is a component of due process.
Yes.
He can't be sued for any other conduct that would constitute a violation of the defendant's right to fair trial.
Correct.
Because that's absolute immunity.
Correct.
Okay, so we've got that. But
yes.
if to the extent that a prosecutor participates before the probable cause finding in coercing fabricated testimony or other, you know, fabricated hard evidence, planting things at the scene, et cetera, and fails to disclose that. Let's say he goes off the case, some other prosecutor takes the case from the probable cause hearing forward. He's not immunized from a Brady claim.
And under Jones, that would be the case.
Right. That's the distinction here. We don't have any of those scenarios here, with the possible exception of the Fourth Amendment claim, but we don't have that kind of a claim brought in this
Correct.
Case.
Exactly.
So does that mean, if we're thinking about the case in those terms, and that's the right way to think about the doctrine, does that mean Whitlock has to be overruled?
Yes. Because Whitlock essentially carved out the fabrication itself as the
constitutional
as the violation,
wrong.
As opposed to the due process, fair trial right, the 14th Amendment right, which is actually what goes through the cases from Jones to Buckley to Fields itself
okay.
in the first opinion here.
So where Whitlock went wrong is that it located the constitutional wrong in the mere fabrication of the evidence.
Correct.
And then went through this chain of causation and supervening causes and intervening causes, et cetera, to the violation that occurs at trial.
Which was actually contrary to this court's opinion in Buckley, viewing the Supreme Court's opinion in Buckley as far as where the location of the injury in the Constitution. And,
right. Well, but to be fair, Whitlock did address Buckley and tried to reconcile.
I mean, the Supreme Court case.
Okay.
Because
I don't understand. Why should the... I don't understand why the determination of probable cause is critical. If you have a prosecutor who just operates as an investigator and doesn't actually present the case, he's a prosecutor, or he's called a prosecutor, but he just does investigation. Why should his liabilities be any different from those of an investigator who isn't called a prosecutor?
And that's the point we're making in our case here, is that under the case law, starting with Jones and dealing with police officers, the fabrication of evidence, i.e. witness testimony, is not a violation of the law. The only violation comes at trial and becomes a Brady violation, and it's only where these
I don't understand that. The fabrication is obviously why isn't that a deprivation? Why isn't that a deprivation of liberty without due process? If you fabricate evidence and it's used to convict a person wrongfully, why does it matter that you're called a prosecutor when you weren't involved in the prosecution? You were just involved in, you know, collecting and creating false evidence.
But it doesn't, Judge, and that's why I suggest it's important not to conflate the issues of whether or not there's a constitutional wrong, which is the qualified immunity issue, with whether or not there's a prosecutor, which is the absolute immunity issue. The absolute immunity issue is
but
off the table when we're talking about the qualified immunity issue. We're only talking about whether or not it states a constitutional wrong in this court itself.
I don't understand. Why isn't it a constitutional wrong to fabricate evidence, which is then used to convict a person wrongfully?
Well, as this court suggested in Buckley 4...
What's the reason?
Because there's no violation of the location of the injury.
That's the conclusion.
Fabrication of evidence doesn't violate the plaintiff's rights. It doesn't injure him until it's used at trial.
Of course it injures him.
How is it injure him? And I think that's the question.
Because it's used in a trial against him.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not the fabrication. It's the use in the trial without...
But how many angels are dancing on the head of your pin?
But, Judge, I think it's important. I mean,
why is it important? The point is you have someone. He's not the prosecutor. We understand why you have absolute immunity for prosecutors. But if you have someone who, although he does prosecute, in this particular case, he's just being used as an investigator, and he's just fabricating evidence, which obviously has a tremendous impact on the defendant, why isn't that actionable? I don't get it.
Because the Supreme Court and this court says it's not.
That's not a reason.
Because the violation...
That's an appeal to authority. I'd like to have a reason, if there's a reason. Now, maybe it's just an unreasoned decision by the Supreme Court which binds us. That's possible. But maybe there's a good reason.
Because
is there a reason?
Because the decision has to be anchored in the Constitution. And in this case,
there's
means
plenty
the
of language in the Constitution, right, about depriving people of liberty without due process.
And notice, Your Honor, when you're talking about the injury, you're talking about depriving of liberty, which suggests the use at trial, and that further includes the fact that the circumstances surrounding that evidence...
Well, what is the sense? Is there any common sense to your position?
Yeah, we're talking about a fair trial right here. That's where the injury occurs, when the evidence is introduced and used to convict at trial without informing the criminal defendant.
Why does it matter when the injury occurs? If you fabricated the evidence well enough, you can be certain that this defendant is going to be injured, namely wrongfully convicted. Why aren't you responsible for that?
Well, I think the simple answer is under basic tort theory, there is no injury without, or there's no damages without injury. And it's just a simple fabrication itself.
Yes, but the injury doesn't have to be simultaneous with a negligent act. Think of products liability. You produce a defective product. 10 years later, it blows up in someone's face. You're responsible for a tort violation. The wrongful behavior and the injury don't have to be simultaneous.
Well, I can suggest, Your Honor.
You understand that, I'm sure.
I do, Your Honor.
So what's the difference here? You fabricate at time one, and at time two, the person is convicted on the basis of the fabricated evidence. Why aren't you responsible for that injury?
You're responsible to the extent there's a Brady violation connected with that, with the false testimony. And that's why this court held...
Brady. You fabricated evidence. Now that evidence is used to convict someone. Why aren't you responsible for the injury?
If you would not, for instance, you would not be responsible if the fabrication itself was disclosed to the criminal defendant and that was used.
Of course we're not talking about disclosure of the fabrication evidence to the defendant. That's ridiculous. I fabricate evidence. I obviously don't tell the defendant I fabricated evidence. He's convicted on the basis of the fabricated evidence. Why am I not responsible for his conviction?
The responsibility lies at trial, Judge. And that's why this court...
No, you're not you're not thinking.
The location of the injury is
you're not thinking like a person. You're thinking like a semanticist. Anything else you want to say?
My time is up, Your Honor.
No, that's
why don't
okay.
you try to explain the difference between qualified immunity and absolute immunity in the prosecutorial settings? Maybe that might aid your dialogue with Judge Posey.
Well, as I suggested earlier, for this purpose, we're not talking about absolute immunity because it doesn't really depend on whether there's a prosecutor or not. Although, at the end of the day, the fact that the prosecutor, and in this case, the prosecutors actually introduced the testimony and evidence, so they were aware of the nature of the fabrication, so to speak. For the purposes of question of whether or not the fabrication itself constitutes an injury, a constitutional wrong, doesn't matter whether you're a prosecutor or not. That's a question of whether or not there's a constitutional violation, period. Immunity is not a defense to liability, it's just an immunity to suit. So, inflating those issues often clouds them, as I think has happened in this area in a number of these cases. The role of fabrication, even if they're police officers, starting with Jones, and I think that's what the court said in Buckley 4 later, had the prosecutors known of what the police officers did, it might be a different story as to whether the police themselves were liable. So even in that case, the police, investigator, what have you, doesn't depend on the identity of the individual, would not be liable. What matters is whether or not the information is provided to the criminal defendant, which is why it's anchored in the 14th Amendment. It's a fair process due trial right. So in a case like this, where that becomes a prosecutor's decision with full knowledge of the alleged fabrication, the falsification of the testimony, that's where the violation occurs, and B, that's why prosecutorial immunity comes into play, because at that point, it's the prosecutor's decision and introduction of that evidence into trial, which is the locus of the injury.
Without a disclosure of its corrupt origin.
Exactly.
Which is what the Due Process Clause gets at.
Yes. Yes. Okay, my time is expired.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Mr. Garcia. Mr. Goodman?
Yes, thank you. May it please the Court. I'm a lawyer for Nathan Fields in this matter. Judge, we submit that the lower court correctly found that Assistant State's Attorney Wary was not entitled to qualified immunity for the claim that he manufactured evidence against Nathan Fields prior to the time that there was probable cause to arrest Fields. And the lower court's opinion was based on this court's opinion in Whitlock from last year, and we believe that Whitlock was correctly decided.
Can Whitlock be reconciled with Buckley?
Yes, Judge. Well, the Whitlock court explained...
I don't understand the distinction.
Well, what the Whitlock court stated was that Buckley is... Buckley dealt with claims of improper tactics. It did not deal directly with the claim of manufactured false evidence.
That's another Jesuitical problem, I think, that the district court in this case rightly had difficulty grasping. I'm not sure what the distinction is. It's all misconduct. It's just a matter of degree. And the question is, how is it actionable under the Constitution? You haven't made a Fourth Amendment false arrest claim as
no.
against Wary in his role as an investigator. You've made a 14th Amendment due process role.
Correct.
So we have to analyze this in terms of due process. And the due process clause kicks in after the probable cause hearing and concerns itself with perversion of the trial process. Now, that's cognizable under Brady and the violation of the disclosure duty. If exculpatory evidence about the corrupt origin of this evidence isn't disclosed, it's a Brady violation and actionable against a police officer or a prosecutor to the extent that the prosecutor participated in the origins of the corrupt evidence, but not its introduction. Because if that same prosecutor had been the one to introduce it, there's absolute immunity. So why don't you address the claim on those grounds?
Well, the Whitlock court found that the prosecutor is who goes out prior to probable cause, goes out with the police, as is the allegation in this case and was the allegation in Whitlock.
I'm not questioning that Wary was performing an investigative role just like a police officer, no different, up until the probable cause determination. So he doesn't get absolute immunity for that. He gets, at best, qualified immunity. What's the nature of the claim that you're bringing against him? If it's not a Brady claim?
It's a due process claim.
Okay. What is the due process violation?
Well, it's the exact claim that was analyzed in Whitlock.
Okay.
That is that
and I'm
he,
having some
that,
difficulty with that,
he,
so tell me what it
fabricated
is.
Fabricated false evidence from a fellow named Anthony Summer, evidence that they knew was false.
I understand that, but the fabrication itself isn't a constitutional wrong.
Well, the Whitlock court said, yes, it can be if that fabrication is a proximate cause, as Judge Posner was saying, of the injury.
Why is that correct?
Well, it's correct because a police officer would be liable. So why would the fact that
the police officer is liable for a Brady violation? If the evidence is introduced, you know, if there's no disclosure, I should say, if there's no compliance with the Brady duty of disclosure, the police officer can be sued for a Brady violation. And to the extent that the police officer who was involved in the origination of the corrupt evidence participates in its introduction at trial as the case agent, as a testifying officer in some other way, the police officer can be liable for a due process violation that occurs at trial by participating, assisting in its introduction. He doesn't get immunity in the way that the prosecutor does. So there might be a due process fair trial right implicated in that scenario. But I'm asking you to clarify, what is the nature of the due process claim that you're alleging against Wary?
The due process claim is the fabrication of evidence for the use later on. And I think the law is clear, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Buckley also recognizes that a police officer is liable for a due process.
No, the court went out of its way specifically not to decide the substantive constitutional issue. It was purely immunity decision, and the opinion says in many places that we're not deciding the substantive constitutional claim and whether this is actionable.
Well, Judge, there's plenty of authority for the fact that a police officer is liable for violating due process, for fabricating evidence, which is then used to put
Brady.
A person on death row.
Under Brady. For violation of the due process duty articulated in Brady. You're making a freestanding. I mean, you're making some Brady claims in this case too, as I understand it, against the officers.
The Brady claim is gone because it was rejected by this court in the prior decision.
No, against.
Against where?
The prosecutor, right? You've got Brady
yes.
claims against the officers involved in
That's
this case,
correct.
Right?
That's correct.
Right. The officer, the prosecutor gets immunity if he's the trial prosecutor.
I understand, but obviously the claim at issue here is a due process claim. And it is identical to the claim that was discussed in Whitlock. And it is a claim that could be brought against a police officer. And as this court stated in Whitlock, a prosecutor who, prior to probable cause, acts like a police officer should be liable in the same respect that a police officer would be liable for fabricating evidence. And that's the situation in this particular case. And the Whitlock court specifically looked at Buckley 4 and said that case is distinguishable because Buckley 4 dealt with tactics. That is, the tactics of witness shopping, the tactics of
It could be
paying.
The tactic of even coercion.
Yes.
Because you can coerce something that may or may not be truthful, Mr. Goodman, right?
That's correct.
Whereas
that's
in fabrication...
Fabrication is fabrication.
So there is a distinction there, is there not?
There is a distinction, and I think it's very well reasoned in the Whitlock opinion to explain what that distinction is. Yes, you can pay witnesses for testimony, you can go witness shopping, and you can still come up with truthful testimony. But when you're fabricating evidence, which in this case... There was no question, at least we believe the evidence will show, the known facts, the eyewitness accounts, were directly contrary to what the story that ASA Wary cooked up with Anthony Sumner. Here we have a situation where, for example...
The fabricated evidence in both cases is testimony that has allegedly been coerced or otherwise improperly... Or a statement from a witness initially and then later testimony that has been improperly coerced or obtained from a witness. So the tactics versus fabrication distinction completely collapses in the context of how the investigators are dealing with witnesses. When you're talking about, you know, boot prints, which was physical evidence in the Buckley case, or if you're talking about planted throwaway knives or other kinds of fabricated evidence, you might be able to draw a distinction. But when you're talking about how investigators deal with witnesses and trying to draw a distinction between improper tactics like coercion, paying money, threatening relatives, other kinds of things, and quote-unquote fabricated testimony, it's all part and parcel of the same thing.
Well,
the distinction breaks down.
Again, Judge, all I could say is I believe that the Whitlock court got it right. And
tell me what the distinction is in the context of witness statements, which is what we've got here.
The distinction is in some cases, for example, the claim that was at issue in Buckley 4 was a claim involving improper tactics, that is, witness shopping, paying for witnesses. There was not a specific claim that the prosecutor manufactured false evidence, knowing it to be false. That was the claim in Whitlock. That is the claim in Fields.
But in Whitlock, it was coerced testimony, right? A coerced witness statement.
Well, it's described as a fabrication.
It's described as fabrication, and...
Do we know what it is or what it was?
The Whitlock...
Or are we, again, just talking semantics here?
Well, it was...
I think Whitlock makes clear that fabricated evidence is false, whereas witness shopping, even coercive interrogation of witnesses, don't necessarily add up to a constitutional violation because evidence collected with these kinds of suspect techniques, unlike falsified evidence and perjured testimony, may turn out to be true. That may be a very fine distinction, but that is the Whitlock distinction. And so you're really relying on Whitlock, right? That's
yes, we're relying on Whitlock as
the distinction that Whitlock makes between its case and Buckley.
Correct. We're relying on Whitlock, and again, the issue here is qualified immunity. There's no question that State's Attorney Worry was not absolutely immune at the time he went out with the police and worked with Anthony Sumner. The question is, does he have qualified immunity? And in this particular circumstances, and Whitlock carved out an exception for pre-probable cause fabrication of evidence that is later used to convict the defendant at trial. That is a limited exception that carved out in the Whitlock case, and in that case, there is no qualified immunity. If the prosecutor, when he went out to coerce Sumner, was already part of the trial team, if there already was probable cause and this was an additional witness, then we would have a qualified immunity situation.
Isn't the probable cause line very artificial? Isn't there an argument that it's good to get the prosecutors involved at the very earliest stage because they'll head off some silly prosecutions, and they'll also control the police more effectively and prevent errors from creeping into the investigation?
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to speak to that, Judge, whether that's good policy. I know that generally prosecutors are brought in to review evidence to approve felony charges. That's usually the first time.
I think they are sometimes brought in very early. If the police are uncertain, what should they do in this case? And you don't want to deter them from being involved before the probable cause determination. I would think you wouldn't want to deter them.
I would agree with that if we had a situation where the prosecutor is advising police on constitutionality, not if you have a situation where a prosecutor is sitting down with a witness and cooking up
a story. The point of immunities is to protect these officials from being harassed. So if you have a situation where there's no, where they lose their immunity if they do anything before there's a probable cause determination, you may rigidify the enforcement process. That might be undesirable.
I understand what the court is saying. I think if you were talking about a case with different facts where this was just advising police officers about the law,
immunity covers bad behavior. Okay.
Right.
So you can
point.
Set aside the innocuous stuff. It is undeniable that Whitlock undermines the absolute immunity of a prosecutor.
Well, Whitlock talks about, I don't think there's any question that there was no absolute immunity.
It's an end run around the immunity of a prosecutor. Absolute immunity post probable cause. The prosecutor can't be sued from probable cause forward, but can be sued for something that occurred before that on this alternative theory, that the creation of the false evidence is an independent, cognizable constitutional wrong, despite the fact that it doesn't happen until there's a deprivation of liberty after conviction by the use of the evidence, for which the prosecutor is absolutely immune.
Again, I don't know that it's an end run.
I just described the end run. Is there something wrong with my description?
Well, I think that it makes sense that a prosecutor who acts like a police officer goes out on a raid, gets a witness prior to the time that there's any probable cause against Nathan Fields, and has the witness cook up a story that if the police officer would be liable for that conduct, that a prosecutor should be liable for that conduct. Now, once there's probable cause, the issue is a little bit different because now the prosecutor can say, I'm acting as an advocate, I'm part of a team, I have a judicial role in the case. But prior to probable cause, there is no such excuse, and I think that there should not be immunity, and I think Whitlock got it right.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Goodman.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Garcia, your time expired, but you can have another minute or so if you'd like.
Well, I think maybe I just want to follow up to the questions you were asking Judge Bowser and Judge Sykes. Our office has a felony review unit for exactly that purpose. It was a reform, actually, back in the late 60s, early 70s. And the idea is to go out when police feel they have enough evidence for felony charges to review that, basically with an eye to whether or not there is sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction.
In what types of cases do you do that?
Felony. It's only felony.
Every felony case you send out in advance of charge, an assistant state's attorney?
Some cases the state's attorney does not actually go to the state. But yes, the simple answer is yes, but for some property crimes, they're usually not. They usually go out. But normally, this is like a 24-hour unit. A felony review assistant will be sent out to the police station to review, which includes interviewing witnesses, reviewing whatever evidence they have, and deciding whether charges are made or not. I can tell you there's a blog that I understand is maintained by the police that are upset when we reject charges. I mean, that happens. And the idea was exactly that, to filter it so not every case got charged. That's why, and that's
a review as opposed to participation in the interviewing of people that the police have talked to. Is that correct?
They actually do interview. And the idea is, and I think
they sit with the arrestee.
Oh, well, if the arrestee agrees to talk and
that's
Miranda,
a
yes,
I understand that.
Well, because quite frankly, it is helpful for a prosecutor to hear what the potential defendant's story is, or if they want to talk, or what they don't. But usually, again, that's consistent with Miranda, whether they agree to or want to or not. And oftentimes, they do. But witnesses as well, and that's obviously for the purpose of a prosecutor.
All right. So when that happens, let's say that's a Cook County situation. And they go to the station. The person agrees to speak to the person. But in the course of it, there's a coercive effort made. Okay? Well, what's the situation for the prosecutor there? That's tactics, right?
Well, when you say coercive, and that's...
Well, he just keeps leaning on.
Well, that's the issue in a lot of cases. As the law is developing, and that's another issue, another area where the law is really developing, because that's where the gray area becomes, whether it's a prosecutor doing a prosecutor's job in simply interviewing and finding out the story, or whether it's something more. And the line the cases are drawing is whether or not the prosecutor allegedly participates in coercing a statement from the defendant. In other words, if the defendant has already made an inculpatory statement before the prosecutor arrives, then immunity would attach. And that's how the cases have come down.
He's made a statement. The suspect has made a statement.
Correct.
And the assistant state's attorney decides that he wants to double-check that, and so he then...
Usually it's...
He asks the same questions the police asked?
Well, usually it's memorialized, and it's either written or oral, or tape, court-reported.
Right.
They're given an option, which and it's.
But is your argument?
Cases,
are you arguing that the prosecutor who's doing this has absolute immunity, or does that not attach until the 48 hours later there's a probable cause hearing?
The prosecutor would have absolute immunity, except for cases where the prosecutor actually coerces a confession, and that's the law. I'm not saying that. I'm not conceding that prosecutors coerce confessions. What I'm saying
is that
if the prosecutor actually coerces a confession from a suspect, that's not a prosecutorial action. However, taking the statement of a suspect who's already confessed and just moralizing that statement, even
so you're saying as if you're doing prosecutorial type things,
that would be for the, that's exactly
then you're protected with absolute immunity, even though it's pre the probable cause.
Right, and that's why I wanted to address it, given you raised that exact point, where that starts getting fuzzy, and the line the Supreme Court drew in Imbler, which seems like a black line that may have practical implications of just whether probable cause is attached, where you have, our office has the luxury, perhaps, with budget reasons, we've cut back on attorneys, but to have a funder unit to do that, to screen the felonies, but that's...
Are you there to establish whether there is probable cause?
For arrest, no.
Arrest has occurred, I understand. Well, I suppose you're reviewing the probable cause of that, right?
Basically, it's to determine whether there's sufficient evidence to sustain a conviction.
Right.
It's a charging decision, it sounds
correct.
Like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's a prosecutorial function.
Seeking whether we'll approve. who felony charges.
Right. That's very different from what's alleged here. We don't have to worry about that. That's clearly functionally prosecutorially, prosecutorial.
What I would suggest here as well, what we have here is a case where there's a police investigation for a year. And there's a lot of this is not in the record now, so I'm going beyond that. But it involved a very large investigation, the Elrukins, involving both our office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, ATF, what have you. So they went out to this safe house in Cleveland. They brought along ASA Worry. I think the record would reflect he didn't really have any interaction with Sumner at the safe house, and that's what the deposition testimony has been. But he's out there to interview and get statements from the witnesses, to whether or not for Fields or what have you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Garcia and Mr. Goodman. Our last case for argument is Olson versus Moore.